Thank you. I'd like to invite everyone to join now in a time of meditation, please. I'll be doing it here. So let's become aware of our breathing. With every exhalation, letting go of any thoughts of the past, letting go of whatever it took to get here this morning. Letting go of any thoughts of the future. Allowing ourselves to enter more deeply into this present moment. The only holy moment is right now. And we give thanks for this precious opportunity that we have to be gathered here in this sanctuary. We give thanks for this community. We know that this outer sanctuary is a manifestation of the inner sanctuary, where we dwell always in unity with the Infinite Spirit. The source of all life. We know that this sanctuary is also a manifestation of our yearning to awaken to the truth that we are. And we give thanks for all of our loved ones, for all of the teachers in our lives, and for all of the teachings of the world's spiritual traditions that turn our minds away from the delusion of separateness into the truth of the infinite interconnectedness of all life. We give thanks for this beautiful earth, for the oceans and islands, the rivers and mountains and streams and forests and prairies, jungles and deserts, for all of the beings, the non-human animals, celebrating their lives as birds in the air, as fish and other animals in the water, the other animals on the land. We give thanks knowing that we are part of a grand celebration of life on this planet and in our universe, and that the light that shines, the heart of the universe, is shining also in our heart, in every cell of our being, awakening and bringing our lives into deeper harmony with the truth that we are. And we give thanks knowing that we have a purpose for this life, a reason that we are here. And we allow ourselves to go more deeply to connect with the truth that we are. And together, we take a moment to enter into the silence, to breathe together. Manifestations of one life. Abiding in our true home, abiding in love and compassion, in joy and in peace, in abundance and in freedom, in equality and in justice, and in gratitude for the precious opportunity of a human birth. May all beings be happy and at peace. May all beings be free. May we all realize the original brightness of our minds and hearts. And may we continue together to build a more enlightened society. A world that cares for everyone. A world that reflects the truth that we are. Through the power of the Infinite Spirit, of truth, we give thanks, knowing this is so. So it is. I'd like to just move into a short piece of original piano music called The Garden, which was, the melody came to me when I was in Ukraine, as part of the Soviet Union, when I was there doing a series of concerts for peace. And so I'd like to just dedicate this piece of music to the healing of all of our relations and to creating a field of peace and freedom in our consciousness and in our world. Invite us all, as we're listening, to listen with our intuition beyond the rational dimension to our true nature. This is The Garden.
morning.
It's great to be here. Madeline and I just came up from California, and I'm so glad to be able to share this morning with you and talk a little bit about how we can create a culture of peace. And I think really, I'm just going to dive right into it here. I think essentially, when we look at the teachings of the world religions, and this is a fascinating thing, I think, to study. I used to teach courses in comparative religion in the San Francisco Bay Area in a couple of colleges there. And I think you can essentially boil the teachings of the world religions down into fundamentally two basic principles. Number one, the saying by Jesus and in the Old Testament as well, love God. Number two, love your neighbor. Right? So what does this mean exactly? Love God, I think, essentially has to do with the notion of creating an authentic connection within our own consciousness with the transpersonal dimension, something beyond the conditioning, the mere conditioning that we've been subjected to by our society and by our culture growing up and continue to be bombarded by messages from Walmart and McDonald's and everybody else telling us what to do and what to think and how to be. But to connect with a knowing that transcends that in some way, that's authentic for us, that goes beyond a mere programming. And I would say, actually, that I refer to that as intuition. And I think there really is no spiritual path until we have authentically connected with our intuition, with something beyond just the rational conditioned thinking. There's nothing wrong with rationality and conditioning. It goes on. And it's part of our circumstances here. But I think all of us can learn to quiet our minds in a certain way and connect with an inner knowing that can guide us. And I think when that happens, then our spiritual path starts, because then we start to be guided by something that's not just the voices of our parents, our ministers. Nothing against the Unitarian ministers. I think they're great. the corporate advertising, the whole program of our society. It's very powerful. We live in a society, but that society lives in us. And so very often our goals and our aspirations and what we're doing every day is actually not from us. It's from our conditioning and the programming. And we become slaves, in a sense, to that. And we're just sort of doing what we're told. We're just doing what we're told, what we've been told since we were little infants. And we may go to church every Sunday, but there's no spiritual path happening. We're just doing what we've been told. So the idea is to connect authentically with what we truly are. That, to me, is what loving God is about. Loving and connecting authentically with what is beyond just the conditioned little put-together contraption that we think we are. The second aspect is loving our neighbor. And I think this is absolutely as essential, because we're essentially, again, programmed by our society to look out for ourselves or for the little group around us. And that creates enormous struggle. My training is primarily in the Buddhist tradition, and there's this notion of samsara. Samsara is basically the suffering. It's the illusion. It stems from the illusion that what I am is a fundamentally separate self, that what I am is merely that which was born and will die, an object, a thing, a piece of matter. And when that notion is injected into us at a very young age, and we believe it, as we do in our society, then we tend to create social structures and a whole world in which I'm trying to get what I want in various ways, and of course others are trying to get what they want. I'm trying to keep away what I don't want. And so there's this constant struggle going on, and it can be gross or it can be subtle, but I'm afraid I'm going to lose what I got, and I'm afraid they're going to take it or whatever. So we're in this continuous struggle, and it's based on an illusion that what I am is this thing, this fundamentally separate thing. So in the Buddhist tradition, the idea is that samsara is without end. It doesn't end. I mean, in the sense that as long as we are engaged in that, we can accumulate vast quantities of wealth and so forth, or many friends, or all these things we try to get. But ultimately, we are afraid we're going to lose them. So the idea, essentially, in the spiritual teachings of the world, is to work internally, in the sense that we are called to question the official stories of our culture and the official stories going on in our own mind, and actually do what we can to directly experience that what we are is what makes this possible. There's a saying in the Buddhist tradition that may seem a little bit extreme, but the saying is that if we're at the beach and we see some footprints in the sand, we don't go up to the footprint and say, "Well, hello, John. How are you this morning?" We know that that's just the footprint. That's not John. Well, essentially, what we're saying, what the teachings really are in many ways, is that what this is, what you're seeing right now, is a footprint. You can't see the being that is the eternal life that's making this. We see just the outer forms, and we take them to be real. And so, in many ways, what we're called to do is to question the ideas in our society that keep us in a shallow level. And once we begin to do that, we begin to feel a sense of love, I think, for others that goes beyond what race they are, what gender they are, what lifestyle they have, what species they are. We begin to see others as we are, as manifestations of the same life. And I think when this begins to happen, then morality and ethics and so forth don't have to be enforced from the outside, because we really be like my fingers. We realize that we're essentially this finger and this finger. Don't have to argue about who's better and who's taller and who's stronger, because they're both here to help and do the same thing, right? To play the piano or whatever it is, or cook and so forth. And so we begin to realize that we are like that. We are actually all manifestations of one life, here to learn to cooperate and love and protect and guide and care for and teach and bless each other. And really the greatest joy we can ever have as a human being is to uncover and present to the world our unique gifts, our unique blessing that we're here to give. There really is no ultimate joy and satisfaction in acquiring things or keeping things away, getting big walls and getting a lot of stuff or whatever it is. It comes from uncovering and giving what we're here to give in a way that is true to ourselves, that it's our unique gift. And that comes from our intuition, from connecting with who we are authentically, from that idea of loving God, loving the transpersonal, finding out what that is, and then presenting that. And we're not encouraged to do that in our society, but I think when we do that, the more any individual connects with our intuition and the spiritual dimension of ourselves, the greater gifts we can give to the world. We just naturally, without even trying, begin to bless others because we're no longer part of the program. There's a great saying, I think, by Krishnamurti. He said, "It is not a good idea to be well adjusted to a profoundly sick society." I just love that saying. Because all of us, we want to be well adjusted to whatever society we're born into, whatever it is. It's in the Amazon or it's here in Victoria. We want to get along. We want everybody to like us. We want to eat what they eat and wear what they wear and be successful in their eyes and all that. But at a certain point, I think we begin to awaken spiritually. Our intuition begins to awaken. And we begin to realize that, wait a minute, do I really want to be well-adjusted here to this society? And then we begin, fortunately, we begin to question the official stories, and then we begin to create communities of people who are questioning the official stories and supporting each other in doing that, and living authentically in a spiritual life based on kindness and compassion for others and for ourselves, and awakening and bringing forth the truth that we are. And we begin to question all of the programming. And I think that is the healthiest thing anyone can do. We only have a few years on this planet to live our lives. And we're in a critical time anyway, I think. We all know that. We can't keep going the way we're going, environmentally, economically, and socially, and with the wars and so forth. We have to question everything at a foundational level. And so I'm going to move in a little bit different direction here. But I think in my own life, I'll just talk a little bit and tie it in with the book I wrote, The World Peace Diet. I think, in my own life, I was born and raised back in the 1950s in Concord, Massachusetts. And I remember, it's kind of neat as a Unitarian to be raised in Concord. I learned to swim in Walden Pond. I went to Thoreau School and Alcott School and was born in Emerson Hospital. It was like the Transcendentalists were everywhere, And it was this feeling, there was also, Concord is well known, actually, for the other thing, which you may or may not relate to, but it's kind of interesting. It was the seat of the American Revolution, and so every day, April 19th, that's Patriots Day back there. And so, my father would get the gun off the wall and get in his Minuteman outfit, and we'd all go down to the old North Bridge in Concord and celebrate the revolution. The idea is, well, if you have a situation that's terrible, you should change it.
And then about 100 years later, there was this, what I think of in some ways as another revolution, the Transcendentalist Revolution, where we had Emerson and Thoreau and Alcott and so forth. And they were in many ways creating a revolution in thought, where they were bringing the teachings of Asia, a lot of the great teachings from the Upanishads and the Mahabharata and the Tao Te Ching and the Buddhist teachings and so forth, and they were beginning to integrate and create a broader conception of divinity, being both male and female, being principle, being mind, not just this anthropocentric kind of male judgmental figure, ridiculous thing. And so this whole movement was in many ways founded there in North America. And in my own life, I remember going away to college, and something started happening to me. This was back in the Vietnam War days, and I was, people were questioning everything. And I remember I found a book called Cosmic Consciousness. And it was written by a Canadian, actually, Richard Buck, back in 1890. You probably haven't heard of it. Anyway, what he said was, most people attain what he referred to as self-consciousness. That's basically caring about myself. And he said, that's where people are at, and it's, you see what that brings. He said there had been certain people, though, that attained what he referred to as cosmic consciousness. This is a sort of a qualitative leap. People like Jesus and the Buddha and the great sages and saints and poets and mystics and so forth through the ages, both men and women, had somehow gotten out of the prison, the box of this narrow self-centered thinking, and lived really to bless others with a sense of joy and gratitude and abundance. They lost the fear of death. They lost the narrow self, kind of clinging. And these people, he said that they attained what he referred to as cosmic consciousness. And he said, which I love this idea, he said, it is the destiny of humanity to evolve to a point where we are living this way in a much more conscious, aware, loving, peaceful way, because we get out of the delusion of self-consciousness and we attain cosmic consciousness. So I remember, anyway, I went back home, and this was toward the end of my 4 years at Colby College in Maine, which was a very expensive kind of elite school there. And I remember telling my father about cosmic consciousness, and I was really learning about this when I was in college, and he was not the most enthusiastic. Well, and he was spending a lot of money on this education for you, and we really want you to, get ahead in the world and, make something of yourself. And but to my delight, my younger brother, Ed, 2 years younger than me, I told him about cosmic consciousness, and he said, yes, let's do it. And I was like, yeah, let's do it. So as soon as I graduated in 1975, we thought about it quite a bit, what we were going to do. Because it's one thing to think, well, okay, it'd be great, but then we're like, what do you actually do? And so we thought about it for a while, and then we came up with a perfect plan. We knew how to attain cosmic consciousness. We would just go to California. That was it. We'd just go there, go to California, go to San Francisco, 1975. I mean, couldn't lose, couldn't miss. It's right there, just waiting for us. So there, I remember heading west. I remember walking down the driveway of our little house in Concord, backpacks on our backs, some fresh baked cookies from my mother. And I remember telling my father, he owned a whole chain of newspapers, and I was going to take it over. And I told him, we're going to go find cosmic consciousness. And bless his heart, to his credit, he said, every man must march to the beat of the drum that he hears. He quoted Thoreau. So anyway, but we marched off to our drum. And I remember after about a month, or I don't know how, 3 or 4, something like that, weeks of working our way west, we had gotten as far as Buffalo. And it was freezing. It was October, and it was like, oh my gosh, I have a degree from a good college. We're in October, and it's in Buffalo. I think we better head south. So we ended up just heading south, and we walked about 15 or 20 miles a day, every day, down through upstate New York, Pennsylvania, West Virginia, down into Kentucky, through Kentucky, down into Tennessee. It took us many months, and we walked. We had no money, not 1 cent. We were just meditating every day. That's what we're doing. We're just living to try to get cosmic consciousness. We're doing these meditation. A guy named Ramana Maharshi from India recommended just asking the question, who am I? Go deeper and deeper. Find out who you are. So we were doing that, and we had all kinds of adventures, but we really discovered, actually, what Jesus said is true. If you seek ye first the kingdom of heaven, everything will be added unto you. We really never went hungry. We just focused on the spiritual path, and we just met a lot of great people and survived and so forth. By the end of the year, toward the end of the year, we walked all the way to Summertown, Tennessee, and we found ourselves in a community there. It was the largest hippie commune in the world. It was called The Farm. Some of you may have heard of The Farm. It was about 900 people there, I guess, when we got there. and they were pretty much all from California. So we thought, well, they met us in the middle. This is perfect, you know. And we stayed there for a while, and actually, just to talk a little bit about the theme in the World Peace Diet, I discovered, actually, that these people were eating a totally plant-based diet. And I had never, you know, I thought about that as we were walking, but I had been raised in a typical family in New England where we ate lots of meat, dairy products, and eggs. And I remember when I was about 7 years old, I said to my mother, I said, Mom, the kind of food we're eating, is that what everybody eats? And my mother said, yeah, everybody eats this. This is what everybody eats. And I said, okay, thanks. I just was wondering. And then she came back a few minutes later, and she said, well, actually, there are vegetarians. And she said it in this way that I knew they lived on another planet. You know? She said, I've never met one. You'll never meet one either. You know, they're just hypothetical people. I mean, where would they get their protein? You know, they don't actually exist. And my mother was right. I mean, I never heard the word again. That was the first time I had heard it, and it was the last time I heard it. And I remember going to Vermont and actually, you know, killing my own chickens. We killed our own cow. We ate the cow, you know, at this beautiful little organic kind of place. And so I saw directly the killing of animals and eating of them and so forth. And I realized, I mean, I just was programmed. I just thought you have to do it because, you know, God said so, and Jesus ate meat, and they don't have a soul, and they taste good, and if you don't eat them, you'll definitely die within 24 hours of a protein deficiency. You know, that's what it is, you know. But when I got to the farm, I saw here was 900 people. A lot of them were children, and they were not dying of a protein deficiency. That was it, you know, and they were just doing great. And I remember, you know, talking to them about it and saying, so why are you doing this anyway? And they said, well, basically, two main reasons. One is that we're growing enough food to feed everybody on the planet, but we're feeding most of the grain and soybeans and legumes and everything to animals while people are starving. You know, and it causes war and violence and devastation of the environment and all that. And I said, okay, that makes sense. And I said, what's the other reason? And the guy said, well, the other reason is, do you know what those poor animals go through? And I said, well, I don't want to hear about it. Don't tell me. And he didn't tell me. He just said maybe one or two sentences. But he just said these animals are confined in these stinking sheds where they never see the light of day. They're just mutilated in a variety of ways, and then they're killed in this horrible way. And my mind was open in a certain way, and it was like I looked into this world, this vast, you know, we're killing in the United States 75 million animals a day, you know, for food. I mean, it's this huge killing machine. And I just looked into it, and I just saw, wow, that's amazing. We're doing that. I didn't realize it. It's this huge, devastating, horrible thing we're doing to animals. And that was it. I never ate meat again in my life that day in 1975. And I found out years later when I met Madeline in Switzerland that she actually never ate meat again in her life since right about the same month and year in 1975. And about 5 years later, I got out. Well, just to kind of wrap up the story, my brother and I ended up walking to Alabama. If you can believe it or not, there was actually a Zen center in Alabama. We ended up at a Korean Zen center. And a few years later, I got out to San Francisco, and I heard about the cruelty to cows and hens for eggs and milk. And I thought, all right, heck with that. So I became a vegan. Have you ever heard of that word, vegan? Anyway, I became a vegan in 1980. So that was 33 years ago. And I would say it was the best decision I ever made, besides marrying Madeline, which was the best decision. But second best decision was going vegan, because really, just the absolute health. You know, last week we had our 20th wedding anniversary, and I had my 60th birthday, and it's just enormously great health-wise. But the feeling of understanding that we don't have to harm animals and ecosystems so violently, I think, has blessed me more than anything. And a few years later, in the early 80s, I went to Korea, and I shaved my head and became a Zen monk. And I was there in a Sungwangsa Zen monastery, and we were getting up at 2:45 in the morning every day and meditating until 9 o'clock at night. It was just sitting. It was just like full lotus on the floor, 12, 14, 16 hours a day, and in silence for months. And I remember it was a wonderful opportunity to just be quiet. And it felt to me like I was gradually, over the weeks and months that went by, extricating my consciousness out of the brambles of all of the conditioning I had endured for 30, at that point I was almost 30, for like 29 years, whatever it was, and gradually realizing directly that what I am, which is what we all are, is consciousness, eternal consciousness. That is what we are. When we our mind gets very quiet. We see that there's just, it's a light of eternal life. And we are here, we've got this body, we're here to understand much at a much deeper level these things. So, but being there, I also realized I was in a community, actually, Sanglongsa Zen Temple, that had been practicing what we would call, they never, you know, like the farm, they never heard of the word vegan either. But they were actually practicing what we would call veganism for like 800 years or something, like since the 1200s, you know, since they were first started. No meat, no dairy, no eggs, no wool, no silk, no leather. Even mosquitoes, you kind of just put them outside, not kill them. Because the idea is, I guess, when you meditate a lot, you get more sensitive to the suffering we're causing others. And we realize if we're causing others suffering, the mind gets agitated. And it's hard to meditate and go deep when we're agitated and hurting others for our own benefit. So that's, I think, coming back to that original teaching of love God and love your neighbor. If we really want to go deep in our meditation and really have clarity in our mind, then it's very important for us to be very impeccable as best we can about not saying and doing things that cause unnecessary suffering to other beings who are capable of suffering. And I know a lot of you probably have companion animals, dogs or cats or other animals. You know that these beings have interests, and they don't like it if you step on their tail or don't feed them or everything. And same is true with dogs as dogs and cats, with pigs and cows and chickens and fishes and other animals that we're harming as a society. And to realize, essentially, I think, that all of us have been forced since infancy by our society into behavior that we really, if we think about it, it's probably not the best thing for ourselves and for our society and for other people. And so I think as we begin to emerge as humanity, I think it's very important for us to emerge out of the darkness of violence and war and exploitation and oppression of each other and of the ecosystems and of animals. Animals are suffering enormously under our domination. That we can live in a way that is very different. And we can feed everyone easily. We can have abundance for ourselves and for our environment and sustainability and so forth, that if we look deeply into the food program in our society and look deeply into what we're actually doing as individuals, that we can move to a life that's more in alignment with our own values. Which is, because what I realized over the years was that actually vegan values are not vegan values, they're actually my own values. I don't want to harm others, you know, unnecessarily. And I think this is something that we can all think about and try to understand and move in a direction that will bring greater blessings to others. And I think what we find as a side benefit is that we also find ourselves happier and more free of disease and so forth. I haven't actually even been to a doctor in 38 years. there's a lot of benefits on that level, but I never did it for that reason. I really did it for the animals and the hungry people. But I think what we're finding generally is that spiritual maturity, which comes, I think, really through hard work. I think it's basically taking time and being disciplined every day to focus on something beyond just the struggle of our life. And I think as we do that, as we have that kind of discipline and encourage ourselves and each other to do that, then we'll begin to connect with what I believe is our true nature, which is essentially a feeling of joy. I think really we're taught in our society in many ways, and we're forced by our culture in many ways, to disconnect from the natural joyfulness. So I want to just close with this idea, because in the spiritual traditions of the world, very often they do talk about, and the cosmic consciousness, actually one of the overarching ideas is that there's this enormous sense of happiness, of joy, that doesn't need any reason in the outer world. We're just... That if we see, we're taught, I think, in many ways to be worried and to regret and to wish and hope and dang what and always be in the past and the future. But if we can just cultivate a mind that's present and grateful for this moment, and do the best we can to be in integrity and kindness and love and caring for others, it doesn't take a great deal of integrity and kindness to be nice to people who, if you're not, they're going to sue you or they're going to shun you or something. But how do we treat, for example, animals? You know, you can do whatever you want to these animals, and they don't sue us, they don't fight back, they just take it. That's the real test. That is the real test. And what we don't realize, and I talk about this in the World Peace Diet, which I'm really glad it was actually a number one Amazon bestseller a couple of years ago, that our violence toward animals always retaliates. We don't see it in our society, but it does come back. And it comes back as various forms of physical disease, psychological disease, cultural disease, wars, nightmares, all kinds of things. So the thing I think to understand is that we, at our core, are a bubbling spring of joy. And it doesn't need any reason in the outer world. And that's, but I'll close with that idea. I remember just the idea and the memory, really, that I had as I was walking with my brother down through somewhere, maybe in West Virginia or Kentucky. Or and we had no reason to be happy. You know, we didn't have any money. We didn't have any security. We didn't know where the next meal was going to come from. But I remember for the first time in my life walking and just having these great feelings of joy just washing over me. And I think that's our natural state. That I think the thing that we were doing at that point was we were living our own lives. We had somehow connected with our intuition. We were living our life. And I think when we're living our life and in some way working to uncover the truth that we are and questioning the official stories of our society and living as best we can according to our intuition and spiritual guidance, that we will find a sense of joy in our lives. It doesn't mean life is easy all of a sudden, but it does mean there's a sense of inner gratitude and happiness that isn't dependent on outer things. And I think each one of us, as we make that effort, we naturally encourage others to do the same thing without even saying anything. We just, in our way of being, and I think when we come together like this in a community where we each are doing our own individual work and we're working together, in the Buddhist tradition, that's called the Sangha. We create a community, and the community is really the foundation. In the Buddhist tradition, they talk about it. Without the Sangha, there can be no Buddha and no Dharma. In other words, no enlightenment and no teachings. It's really so important, the efforts that we make in the community. So I just want to close by thanking all of you, because I know if you found your way through the door and you're here, you wouldn't be here if you hadn't already started questioning the official stories of our society, understanding the wisdom of what Krishnamurti said. It's not a good idea to be well-adjusted to a profoundly sick society and to question even those things that maybe are very ingrained in us. And I want to encourage all of you and challenge you, in a sense, to move beyond what's comfortable and to really being pioneers in the effort. I think, as I said, it's a critical time. We don't have the luxury to keep doing things the way we used to do them. We have to find new ways. And I think compassion for all life is the foundation of it all. And that as we understand that and intuitively and live that way and help others do the same thing, I think then we can be a force for the healing of our planet. And it's the greatest thing to do, I think, while we're here, the short time we have on this planet, to not get tangled up with the program that the culture is trying to ensnare us with, but to actually be, as Thoreau said, a counterweight to all that and create something new. So I hope that we get to see you again. I won't be saying anything more, so I'll just say now, we'll be giving a lecture tonight about my book, The World Peace Diet, at the Ukrainian Center here in Victoria, and tomorrow night a lecture on developing intuition, if you are interested in this. We have a flyer, I think, there, and we have books and CDs and things as well. So, and Madeline has painting. So we're happy to talk to you afterwards if you have any questions and so forth. Much love to you all. Thanks so much for the work you're doing. It's essential, and it's really fantastic. Bless you. Thanks so much.